All right, my friends, it's April the 10th, 2007. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. No guests today, just you, me, and the telephones, and I guess if I really get down and out, I'll just play a rerun. Got a really good interview with Richard Cummings, saved up on the playlist here. He wrote this killer article for Playboy magazine called Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, and provides quite an insight into the role of the military-industrial complex and Lockheed in particular in lying us into the war in Iraq and helping to push for that war. And the next one, that was a really good one. So I guess if it really comes down to it, I'll play that Richard Cummings interview for you guys. But otherwise, I have plenty of news to talk about with you today. And sure would like to take your phone calls if anybody wants to get involved on the air. On Anti-War Radio, the number is here in Austin, 646-6446, 646-6446. If you're streaming live worldwide, anywhere worldwide on KAOS959.com, then just stick a 512 in front of that, 512-646-6446. And yeah, again, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio, and from the Christian Science Monitor this morning, from hiding, Sadr rallies against the United States. The radical Shiite cleric throws his strength with large shows his strength with large anti-U.S. rallies in the cities of Kufa and Najaf. Baghdad, yes to Muqtada, yes to Iraq, yes to liberation, chanted tens of thousands of demonstrators as they poured into the revered Shiite cities of Kufa and Najaf Monday, calling for U.S. troops to leave Iraq. Now, the first numbers I saw were hundreds of thousands, but I wasn't there, so I don't know. The event on the fourth anniversary of Baghdad's fall was a clear message from Muqtada al-Sadr that the radical Shiite cleric remains a force to be reckoned with, despite the fact that he has been in hiding for months. His movement is under growing military pressure from U.S. forces, including battles with Sadr's Mahdi Army militia in the city of Diwania, south of Baghdad, that have killed at least 11 Iraqis since Friday. It might also show that the Iraqi people, particularly the Shiite Arabs, who have been pretty tolerant of us so far, since it's their political factions who have gained all the political authority, maybe that they're sick and tired of the American presence. But no, let's make this all about one guy. Continuing here. It proves that he's the only man capable of amassing such a huge demonstration and shows the weakness of the government and its allies, said Wamid Namhi, a political science professor at the University of Baghdad. Oh, well, that's funny, because he's part of the government. The Muqtada al-Sadr movement, the Mahdi army, they're part of the United Iraqi Alliance. They are basically the army of the Dawah Party, which has no army. They're the surrogate army, I guess I should say, of the Dawah Party. The demonstration, in which only Iraqi flags were allowed, was also an opportunity for Sadr to mend fences with moderate Sunnis, given that his militia has been implicated in the wave of sectarian killings that have engulfed the country. Monday's marchers included some Kurds in traditional dress, as well as Sunni clerics, many of whom were bussed by Sadr's movement from the city of Basra in the south. "Let's put out the fire of discord and chop off the snake's head," chanted some in reference to Iraq's ongoing sectarian strife. Sadr issued a statement Sunday calling for an end of fighting in Diwania because members of his militia and U.S. and between members of his militia and U.S. and Iraqi forces. Quote, "The forces of darkness led by the occupiers, U.S. forces, are planning discord among the sons of the same nation. My brothers in the Mahdi army and the security forces, stop fighting because otherwise you're promoting the agenda of your common enemy," said the statement. To the Iraqi army and police, do not follow the orders of the occupier because he is your enemy. The majority of the Iraqi police and army are Shiites, and some of the demonstrators were wearing army uniforms. On Sunday, tens of thousands of Sadr supporters crammed into the backs of trucks or into minibuses draped with giant Iraqi flags to make the 100-mile journey south to Najaf. Passengers waved flags from honking vehicles. On arrival, people slept in parks, on sidewalks, and even inside Najaf's famed Valley of Peace Cemetery, which was the scene of vicious fighting between Sadr's partisans and U.S. forces in 2004. Huge vats were wheeled out on the streets to cook for the crowds. The demonstration kicked off early on Monday morning amid tight security, including a ban on vehicle circulation inside Najaf and Kufa. In addition to the Iraqi police and soldiers, dozens of armed members of Sadr's movement fanned out among the crowds. Protesters waving Iraqi flags and carrying banners emerged in groups from Kufa's Grand Mosque, walking about 6 miles to the 1920 Revolution Square in Najaf. The square, named after the Shiite uprising against British colonial rule, is also known as the Sadrain Square, in homage to Sadr's father and great-uncle, both slain under Saddam Hussein's regime. "No, no, America. Death to America," read some of the banners. "I want the occupation to leave right away, now, no timetable. We want to be ruled by Iraqis only," said Farhan Turki, one of the protesters. State-owned television carried segments of the demonstration live, but characterized it as a celebration of the fourth anniversary of the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime. 4 years ago, U.S. soldiers toppled a 20-foot-high statue of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad's Firda Square. A crowd of Iraqis swarmed over the statue and danced on it. And again, as we talked about yesterday, that crowd were almost entirely exiles from the Iraqi National Congress, and there was about 30 of them, and it was a big joke. So if the Iraqi people know that they weren't the ones who pulled down the statue 4 years ago, does anybody think that if... TV tells them that the reason 100,000 or so people were protesting in Najaf and Kufa is in favor of the invasion to celebrate their liberation? You know, that sure is, this government sure is getting off on the right foot with these people, right? Just making it abruptly clear that they're at least as full of lies as the American occupation is. Which, you know, of course, it's just one big walking camouflage lie in an aluminum Humvee death trap. Anyway, many Baghdadis, especially in Shiite strongholds, put Iraqi flags on their rooftops or outside their shops. "We respect Sadr's call. Some of his supporters are more active. They will fight and go down to Najaf. Our support is more passive," said Ali Shaker, a pastry shop owner. Iraqi flags fluttered from many of the capital's hospitals and government buildings. Policemen, who are renowned for their support for Sadr, draped flags on the hoods of their vehicles. Colonel Stephen Boylan, a U.S. military spokesman in Baghdad, praised the peaceful nature of the demonstrations. "Iraqis could not have done this 4 years ago." He told the Associated Press that, quote, "This is the right to assemble, the right to free speech. This is progress." Yes, never mind that they all want him to leave, and that's why they're protesting. The U.S. military also issued a statement on Sunday calling the operation in Diwania, dubbed Black Eagle, a great success so far. It said it detained 39 militiamen and killed an unspecified number. It also has uncovered many large caches of weapons, including factories that make explosively formed penetrators, devices that Washington accuses Tehran of supplying to Sadr's militia. Oh, they found the factory where they make these new fancy kinds of IEDs, and it was in Iraq? Huh. I'll just have to fold that up and put it in my shirt pocket for later, I guess. Can't figure out why that isn't the headline here, Christian Science Monitor. A doctor in Diwania, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said by telephone that a 24-hour curfew had been imposed in the city since Friday, and that the hospital so far had received 11 bodies, including 7 civilians and 35 injured people. Diwania has been the scene of on-again, off-again violence over the past year, and the doctor said the fighting has been mainly a power struggle between Sadrists and members of the local government, many of whom are beholden to a rival Shiite faction headed to Abdul Aziz Akim. And so, here we are, my friends. 4 years into the war, and still the phrase that may not be uttered, not even in the Christian Science Monitor, which generally does a much better job than most American newspapers. Dig this. Get this. Memorize this. Remember it for later. Explain it to somebody else. Abdul Aziz Akim is the head of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. That unnamed other rival Shiite faction, according to this morning's Christian Science Monitor. The Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Learn that. Those are the people who are the military of Iraq. That is the government of Iraq. And they, of course, are the Iran factions. Abdulaziz Hakim, of course, lived in Iran for 30 years, waiting for America to finally come and overthrow its own puppet and allow he and his Iranian-backed buddies from Skiri to come and take over the south of that country. 4 years into this war, never mind even TV, you can't even get the name of Skiri in the Christian Science Monitor. Somebody refers to Abdulaziz Hakim, oh, he's just some guy from some other organization. And you know, especially, never mind the idea that somehow they could just say Abdulaziz Hakim of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and assume that we all know what they're talking about, which we all ought to know what they're talking about by now, and yet, since they won't tell us, we still don't know, and so they can't tell us because, geez, then they'd have to give us a whole other couple of paragraphs about how, oh, Hakim, yeah, he represents the Iran factions. So instead, they just won't even mention the name of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the people that America, that is, the Iranian revolutionaries that America has brought in from Iran and given power in southern Iraq. Anyway, continuing here with the Christian Science Monitor, it is a turf battle between the Shiite parties, said Brigadier General, some guy, who was fired 20 days ago from his job as the head of Diwaniya police force. Mr. Hakim is a leading force in the Shiite-led government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, which also includes ministers loyal to Sadr. A senior aide to Sadr says the battle in Diwaniya, as well as the targeting and arrest of Sadrists in Baghdad by U.S. forces, is an all-out effort to draw the Mahdi militia into a fight. They're trying to plunge us into a vortex of violence and sectarian fighting, but we are working hard to rise above it, said Sheikh Hassan al-Zargani, who is based in Beirut. Sheikh Zargani says the movement is committed to, quote, peaceful resistance against the occupation for now, whether by making its voice heard within the government or through street demonstrations. Of course, because ultimately they own the government, so they're not worried. The Shiites control the government. They may want us to go. They may be sick and tired of the violence that the American occupation is causing. But they're not going to panic. As Mr. Beirut just said right there, the Shiites are in the position, the Shiites in Iraq, particularly Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army, they are the, they're in the catbird seat. America has no ability to do anything about them at this point. They are, I think that guy correctly said, America is trying to draw Muqtada al-Sadr's militia into a fight. But apparently he won't take the bait. When the surge, quote-unquote, began, Muqtada al-Sadr told his people, don't fight. In fact, he even told them, go ahead and let the Americans come into Sadr City, the Shiite slum neighborhood of Baghdad, controlled by the Mahdi army. He said, let them come on in. There's no point in getting in a full-scale battle with these guys again. I guess they learned their lesson in 2004 in the battles in Najaf. And so they said, look, sit back and wait, which is basically what the Iranians have been telling the Shiite political factions all this time. Yeah, we know it's tough. We know you don't like being humiliated by this occupying army and everything. But just be patient, because when America leaves, we, that is, the Iranians, will own the South. That's what they've been telling their factions, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawa Party. And I guess it is somewhat debatable to what degree Muqtada al-Sadr himself is loyal to Iran, although he has said if America bombs Iran, he will go to war. My best understanding is that out of the Dawa Party, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, and the Mahdi Army, Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi Army are the least Iran-backed. But of course, as I was saying before, they basically serve as the de facto army for the Dawa Party, which is, of course, backed by Iran. And the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution is the other major Shiite faction, which, of course, was created by the Ayatollah Khomeini in the 1980s and was in exile for 30 years waiting for somebody as stupid as George W. Bush to come in, overthrow the Baathists, and finally allow the exportation of the Iranian Revolution into Arab lands. But anyway, what a disaster. 4 years on, the Shiites have not gone to war yet. And the Shiites basically, over the last 4 years, have been waiting. They mostly moved out of the way and did not oppose the American invasion in the first place, at least not very actively. And they've basically just been biding their time and waiting till they control the whole place. Now, one thing that's happened since the surge and since the increased presence of American soldiers in Shiite parts of Baghdad and Sadr City, for example, is that the numbers of Sunnis who have been showing up on the side of the road with drill holes in their heads, tortured and executed, that is, has gone down. But the death toll hasn't. It's still approximately 100 Iraqis a day are killed, really more than that if you read Margaret Griffiths at antiwar.com keeps a tally of all the Iraqis who are killed and wounded, and it's over 100 every single day. But these are being killed again by the Sunni insurgency. These are mostly Shiites being car bombed at the marketplace. Well, the Shiites basically are in a position, now that the surge has been directed toward them, they're in the position of waiting and biding their time. So, less Sunnis being murdered, just as many or more Shiites being murdered. That's the wonderful results of the surge so far. And you gotta give George Bush credit, you know, when every one of his military advisors is telling him otherwise, he just does the right thing anyway. And commits more troops to an occupation that his own head general, Petraeus, says cannot solve anything. Oh, well, just increase it more. Why not? Here's some more about Muqtada al-Sadr and the thousands, tens of thousands, or was it hundreds of thousands, of Shiites who protested in Kufa and Najaf yesterday. This one's from The Times in London by James Hitter. In Baghdad, tens of thousands of Shia demonstrators rallied to a call by Muqtada al-Sadr, the anti-American cleric, to protest against coalition forces in Iraq yesterday, the fourth anniversary of the fall of Baghdad. The vast gathering of men burning U.S. flags, carrying giant Iraqi ones, and waving banners denouncing President Bush was a huge show of strength for the firebrand cleric. Policemen stayed in their bases, and armed militiamen from Sadr's Mahdi army enforce security. But behind such displays of unity, many point to fault lines developing in the militia, estimated to number 20,000 gunmen. With its leaders in exile, al-Sadr is believed to be in Iran, hiding or in U.S. custody, many militiamen are increasingly frustrated. Iran is thought to be fishing for rogue elements to bring under its influence. Iran is afraid of the Americans now and wants to make sure the Mahdi army can control Iraq and beat the Americans, said Abu Bakr, an al-Mahdi commander in Baghdad. A Western diplomat in Iraq said that there were splits within the militia and the political movement allied to it. Every week that goes by, we've been seeing this since November. There's another example of how fractured it is, he said. Al-Mahdi fighters were ordered to stand down at the start of the U.S. security surge in Baghdad, but to avoid being blamed should it fail. But some are champing at the bit to fight the occupiers. In Diwania, a Shia town in central Iraq, Al-Mahdi forces clashed with U.S. and Iraqi troops before their leader ordered them to allow Iraqi forces to take control. Some see the cracks as a positive sign that parts of the Sadrist movement, a keystone of the government, may be looking for a more constructive political role. Others worry that if it splits, the government will face an unpredictable foe. Developed from an armed militia to protect poor Shia areas after the U.S.-led invasion, the Al-Mahdi army became an influential force. It may now have become a victim of its own success, a sprawling mob that often operates at the whim of local commanders. There are at least three elements, said the diplomat, the criminals and the opportunists, those close to Muqtada and those with an Iranian agenda. Since last summer, I guess the way I read that, it sounded like four. But that was the criminals and opportunists, those close to Muqtada, and those with an Iranian agenda. Since last summer, the militia has been associated with death squads terrorizing the capital, but has tried to distance itself from killers and kidnappers. Abu Haider, an al-Mahdi fighter, said the movement had an intelligence service to find criminals and Sunni terrorists. 30 al-Mahdi members had been executed in the past 5 months for abusing their positions. Despite orders to halt operations, Abu Haider said that al-Mahdi hit squads were still abducting suspected Sunni extremists. Before the latest U.S. expansion in Baghdad, dozens of bodies were dumped on the streets every day, and al-Mahdi militiamen passed easily through checkpoints where soldiers were complicit or cowed. In the boots of their car were victims heading for Sharia tribunals or corpses on their way to the river. Our guys buy cars according to the size of the boot. The Toyota Crown Super Saloon is a favorite, Abu Haider said. You can get four people in the boot. The number of corpses has dropped, but many Shia complain of attacks by Sunni extremists. Unless U.S. and Iraqi troops contain the violence, the militia may return, but with even more popular backing. And isn't it interesting just to hear, and you know, again, the Christian Science Monitor is actually pretty damn good about this kind of thing in their reporting compared to most American papers, but you see the quality, the difference of the quality in reporting from reading even the Times, which is hardly my favorite paper out of Britain. But you see the kinds of things that are allowed in the Times article that are not allowed in, that somehow make it to the floor or never make it into the American article at all. Denouncing Bush, burning American flags and all that. That wasn't included. And the descriptions of the protests in the Christian Science Monitor article, and also the Christian Science Monitor article didn't get into what the Times of London decided to tell you, which was that the surge as being directed against the Shiites, it has cut down on the number of people tortured and executed by the Shiites. But it hasn't cut down on the Sunni insurgency at all. They're going to have to take their very same surge and redirect it the other way. And now here's the major flaw in this whole idea that you're going to solve this problem with military force. Not that I think you're ever going to be able to cut a political deal between these factions either. Of course, the only solution is immediate withdrawal, say, I don't know, a year ago, or three or four. The American policy here is absolutely insane. It's like it was written up by seventh graders or something. We're going to surge all the troops into Baghdad while the ethnic cleansing of Baghdad of all Sunni Arabs is almost complete. We'll go ahead and get that done. But then what, we're going to completely defeat and disband the Mahdi army and the Badr brigades, and all Shiites are just going to become all government employees now, and we'll have no more of these militias going around murdering people. And of course, the government employees never torture and murder anyone. Once they get that American welfare dollar paid for uniform on, they become holy and pure and never do anything bad ever again. But all these militia guys are just going to disappear. And then we get to start the war against the Sunni insurgents up again with, of course, the help of the Shiite militias that we're conquering now as we help them finish cleansing Baghdad of the Sunni Arabs. And this is supposed to accomplish what again? What a joke. I can't believe that, Americans are being sent to die for this. You know, if you're going to tell me a lie, give me one plausible. You know, give me something that I can at least, you know, somehow suspend my disbelief and say, yes, I see how ethnically cleansing Baghdad of Sunnis and empowering the Shiite militias that we're fighting at the same time so that later we can team up with them better to fight the Sunni insurgency some more. I don't know. Tell me you're giving the country to the Kurds. You know, maybe I'll buy that. I don't know. Something. Something that makes, you know, the slightest bit of sense would be nice. You know, it doesn't have to be really good. It doesn't have to be really convincing. But, you know, something that at least sounds plausible. Is that asking too much? I guess it probably is asking too much. Jeez. Yeah, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. The number here is 646-6446-646-6446. But I'm going to take a little break and play a song, and we'll be right back. No, I'm not. Man, I forgot to hit my sound card button again. That thing sucks, man. It sounds bad, doesn't it? Yeah, I know. It's all my fault. I knew better, but I forgot. But I'm fixing it now. It's going to work great now. Chaos Radio in Austin, Texas. Show. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. And, you know, this Thursday, I went back and checked. I guess I got it wrong yesterday. This Thursday, 2 days from now, will be the fourth anniversary of the beginning of me doing the interview show, the weekend interview show here on Chaos Radio in Austin. Of course, I don't know what the real anniversary of my start on Chaos is. I guess it must be sometime late in 2002. I think something like that. Is that about right? Is when I got started. The way shit is, the best I can tell was the first show. And then, 4 years ago Thursday, I started the weekend interview show. My first interview was Alan Bach of antiwar.com and the Orange County Register. And I sent him an email. I'm gonna see if I can get Alan back on the show for Thursday to discuss, well, what he said then about our situation. It was just 3 days after the fall of the statue and the wonderful, successful liberation of the poor, downtrodden, through no fault of our own, Iraqi people, and what's happened since then. So hopefully we'll have Alan Bach on for you Thursday. I have no idea who I'm going to have tomorrow. I must be getting a bad reputation around. Don't do interviews with that guy. He'll ask you important questions or something. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to try not to humiliate myself by doing this too much, because I can sit here and read for 2 hours. If it's really the case that you people would prefer to just sit here and listen to me talk to myself for 2 hours, then by all means, don't call. But, you know, of all the time that I did the Chaos Report, including when I had Shauna Kay as my co-host, I always wish that we could take some phone calls from you people out there in the audience who I know exist for a fact. So, you know, here's your chance if you want to call in. It's 646-6446, 646-6446. If you're from out of town, you're listening, streaming live on the internet, it's 512-646-6446, 512-646-6446, or, you know, me, I'm just going to sit here and talk for another hour and a half. But, you know, it might be more interesting if other people were to try to take part in the conversation. Americans refute link between Iraq and U.S. safety. This is from the Angus Reid Global Monitor. I like those guys, Angus Reid Consulting. They did good work. Many adults in the United States believe the outcome of the coalition effort will not directly affect domestic security. According to the Public Agenda Confidence in U.S. Foreign Policy Index, released by Foreign Affairs. So, apparently this is the same poll I was talking about the other day. That great Jim Loeb article about America's views on foreign policy nearing a crisis point. And, of course, Jim Loeb put the ironic quotes around that. Yes, it's a crisis, according to Foreign Affairs, if you and I don't support our government going around murdering people and stealing the property that belongs to those people in order to give it to members of the Council on Foreign Relations, which produces Foreign Affairs, and who wants all that stuff stolen and given to them, and they don't care how many people have to die. And so it's a crisis when you don't feel the same way, according to the Council on Foreign Relations. And So here's that crisis they're talking about. The coalition effort against Hussein's regime was launched in 2003. At least 3,268 American soldiers have died during the military operation. More than 24,400 troops have been wounded in action. In December 2005, Iraqi voters renewed their National Assembly. In May 2006, Shiite United Iraqi Alliance member Nouri al-Maliki officially took over as prime minister. Let's get to the poll numbers here, man. 51% of respondents would gradually withdraw all troops from Iraq over the next 12 months. 27% think the soldiers should stay in Iraq, and 19% would remove all troops immediately. Wow, so the leave them there is still beating the out immediately. Come on, Americans, what the hell is the matter with you? Although a majority want them out within this year, by the end of this year. No, it doesn't say that. Over the next 12 months, it says. In his April 7th radio address, George Bush discussed the current situation, saying, in both the House and the Senate, Democratic majorities have passed bills that would impose restrictions on our military commanders, set an arbitrary date for withdrawal from Iraq, and fund domestic spending that has nothing to do with the war. The Democrats who pass these bills know that I will veto either version if it reaches my desk, and they know my veto will be sustained. Yet they continue to pursue their legislation. Now the process is on hold for 2 weeks until the full Congress returns to session. I'm not sure who wrote this. They kind of did a sloppy job because they didn't cite all the relevant quotes. The relevant quotes are, if America leaves, then the evil terrorists are going to come here and kill us for our failure in Iraq. That's right. The terrorists really want us to create a successful democracy, I guess, and they'll be terribly upset if we don't create one there, and they'll come here and kill people in your family. That's the quote that you need from George Bush, Angus Reid Consulting here, is that Americans will be in danger if we lose in Iraq, and the American people do not believe that. They no longer believe that. Do you think America's safety from terrorism depends upon our success in Iraq, or does it not depend on our success in Iraq? Does not depend on our success in Iraq, 61%. Depends upon our success in Iraq, 34%. And then, yeah. If you go to Angus Reid Consulting, you can find the link to the PDF file of the whole study there, the whole survey. And the American people, it seems like, are finally coming around to believing in a policy of non-interventionism. Not because really they're against killing foreigners, who of course don't have rights because they're foreigners. But, you know, maybe just because it costs too much, or they're worried that people will kick their ass if they try to go on vacation to Europe, or they're, you know, have some other personal reason. They don't like the embarrassment of having their military humiliated and defeated by ragtag militias armed with nothing more than AKs and the chemicals under their sinks. You know, whatever it is, the American people who answer these poll questions, whatever reasons they have, they're finally against this war, and they no longer believe the lie that somehow they and their family will be put in more danger if America leaves. And now, George Bush is always very vague about, you know, how that might be, but I think he's been specific on a couple of occasions. The accusation, or the so-called worry that we're supposed to worry about, is that somehow Al-Anbar province, you know, so they don't use the word Fallujah on TV anymore, no, or anywhere. Nobody ever talks about Fallujah anymore. I guess Al-Anbar province is the new euphemism for Fallujah, which was never pacified, where thousands and thousands of innocent people were murdered by the American government to no good end whatsoever. Yeah, maybe that's why they don't use the word Fallujah anymore. But apparently the theory that they would like us to believe in is that somehow if America leaves Iraq, Al-Qaeda will take over the Sunni parts of Iraq, and it'll be a failed state, and they'll provide a safe haven, just like the Taliban did for Osama bin Laden and his cohorts. Well, that's just ridiculous. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, such as it is mostly Iraqis. You know, I guarantee it's less than a couple of thousand of foreign jihadists who've come to Iraq to fight. This is not Afghanistan in the 80s, where the United States Treasury and every Arab government was in on the plan to send radicals to go fight. This is nothing like that. And in fact, all the kept imams of the America-friendly regimes in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, the rest of the Gulf states, all those imams have decried Osama bin Laden and forbid people from going to fight some kind of jihad against the American occupation in Iraq. So the Arab Sunni insurgency there in Iraq has the very smallest percentage of it actual foreign fighters. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is a fancy name for, I guess, the religious incline among the domestic Sunni Arab insurgency against the American occupation. Some of them have adopted, religious jargon and are now, you know, so-called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. But, you know, what are we supposed to believe here, George Bush, that some Saudis and some Egyptians are going to be the rulers of Sunni Iraqistan? Is that what we're supposed to believe? That foreigners are going to come and rule over the Sunnis? Let me think if I can come up with any examples in recent history of foreigners failing to pacify the Sunni Arab regions of Iraq. Let me think. Hang on, I'm concentrating. Oh, right. America, the most powerful government in the history of the solar system, has been unable to pacify and control the Sunni areas of Iraq. Right, but Al-Qaeda is going to take them over, huh? And use them as a base to launch attacks against everybody else. Is that it? What a bunch of garbage. When America leaves, the Sunni Arab areas of Iraq are either going to be ruled by A, Baathists, B, local Sunni religious leaders, C, both, combined together in some form of coalition, or D, a brutal occupying force of Shiite Arabs and Kurds. That is who is going to rule the Sunni parts of Iraq. Period. Not Al-Qaeda. Not they're going to be a base and come attack us from Iraq. And you know, even if you do think that, even if you do think, well, we're fighting them there so we don't have to fight them here because God knows there's a finite number of people who are able to get pissed off at America in the world. And, you know, killing little children never inspires hatred and feelings of revenge on the part of their older brothers. That never happens. We know that there's only a finite number of terrorists in the world. Well, all we have to do is invade this country, Iraq, where, well, just screw the millions of people who live there and have had nothing to do with terrorism or Al-Qaeda at all. We're just going to, never mind them. And we're going to turn their country into the flypaper to lure all the terrorists, the finite number of terrorists that there are on Earth, to lure them all into this place and kill them there. And yes, if we completely and entirely destroy Iraqi society in the process, well, screw them. They're just Arabs, not human beings, and they don't have rights. And if all the Assyrian Christians in Iraq have fled, and if all the Jews are gone, and if all the Mandians, all the different ethnic and religious minorities in Iraq, if their societies have ceased to exist, if 4 million people have been pushed from their homes, 2 million have, been lucky enough to make it to another country, 2 million internally displaced, if we've completely shattered this culture, shattered this society, set them at war, sentenced untold numbers of people to die by car bombing or by drill in the head, well, that's just perfectly okay, don't you know? Because we had to invade this country that had absolutely nothing to do with Al-Qaeda and nothing to do with September 11th and was no threat to America at all. Well, you know, they just happened to be in the right place at the wrong time, I guess. And we're just going to turn their country into an absolute pit of hell in order to lure terrorists there so that we can take out that finite number of terrorists. You know, I would rather die by a terrorist than do that to a country of people who had nothing to do with this fight. You know, if that ridiculous, pathetic, sophomoric, childish theory that somehow fighting them there means we don't have to fight them here, if that were true, do you really think it's okay to take a third party country that had nothing to do with September 11th, nothing to do with our fight against Al-Qaeda at all, and turn their country into a pit of hell to lure these terrorists there? I'd rather fight them in Colorado Springs and in Austin, Texas, and in Cincinnati, Ohio. I'd rather fight them here than unleash this hell on innocent people. Why didn't we just invade Mexico for September 11th? Why didn't we invade Brazil and say, all right, terrorists, you want to kill Americans? Come to Brazil. And yes, we'll turn their country into a pit of hell. And yes, they had nothing to do with the attack whatsoever. But hey, it's the flypaper theory. It's better we fight them in Brazil than in America, right? Would that be moral to you? Would that be okay, Republicans out there? To get a bunch of Brazilians killed as long as we're, you know, making flypaper for the terrorists? I mean, here we are 4 years later, and these are the arguments I still have to refute? Come on, guys! Yes, it's perfectly okay, Scott. You know what we should have done? We should have invaded Belgium. Yeah, we should have occupied Belgium and started murdering people and, hosted phony elections based on what ethnicity and religion people are would be the slates for them to vote in the elections. And we could have lured every Muslim radical in Europe and the Middle East to Belgium, and we could have turned their country into a pit of hell. Because, hey, it's the flypaper thesis, and it's better we fight them in Belgium than fight them here, right? Why not? Why not take the war on terrorism to Spain? Why not kill hundreds of thousands of Spaniards? As long as we can lure a few jihadists where we can fight them there better than fighting them here. Would there be something immoral about that? To kill hundreds of thousands of Spaniards in order to do your little flypaper theory? Would that be, oh, I get it. They believe in Jesus, so they're human beings and have rights in Spain. Oh, I'm sorry. No, they're Catholics, so they're not people and they don't have rights. Oh, Catholic is close enough for you? Oh, okay. Catholic is close enough. Okay, good. So Spaniards are people. Spaniards have a natural dignity and a natural right to live, but Iraqis apparently do not. Iraqis apparently are less than human. Apparently it's perfectly okay to kill hundreds of thousands of Iraqis to turn their country into a pit of hell so that by the flypaper theory, the finite number of jihadists on earth will come to be, lined up and properly, executed by having a drill put in their head by our good buddy Muqtada al-Sadr. That's perfectly okay. That's fighting the war on terrorism. That's right. That goes without saying, pal. And, you know, if you think Iraqis are human and that somehow it's immoral to get hundreds of thousands of them killed in order to fight the war on terror over there so we don't have to fight them here, well, then you're the coward somehow. Isn't that funny? Doesn't it seem like the people who would rather fight them in innocent third-party countries that had nothing to do with September 11th, rather than fighting them here, aren't they the cowards? Aren't you the coward who says, oh, man, I don't want to fight them here, so it's better to fight them in Iraq that had nothing to do with September 11th and get hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqi people killed? Aren't you the ones who are the cowards who are afraid to fight them here? I'm not afraid of jihadist terrorism. Are you? Are you really so cowardly and afraid and frightened that you need your daddy, George Bush, to invade third countries that have nothing to do with our fight against the attackers of September 11th? So that they have to be fought there instead of here? Jeez. You know, why not just put on some pink panties and just admit what a big sissy you are and that the reason you vote Republican is due simply to cowardice. Because you're a sissy boy. You're afraid of a little jihadist in his red headband. Oh no, a jihadist in his red headband. I'm so scared. I'm going to vote Republican. That's right. And I'm going to pretend that I'm the tough guy and that you guys are the cowards for not wanting to invade third party countries that had absolutely nothing to do with the September 11th attack. So that it'll be better to fight them there than over here. And just so you know, there was, as Dick Cheney mentioned last week, completely out of context, a slight terrorist connection to Iraq. That's right. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who is not al-Qaeda and who had no relationship whatsoever with Saddam Hussein or Saddam Hussein's intelligence services, lived in American-protected Kurdistan in the north of Iraq. And the military tried over and over again to get the Bush administration to allow them to go into Kurdistan and kill Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and his Anwar al-Islam buddies. And George Bush and Dick Cheney refused the military permission to do that over and over and over again. Why? Because they were liars. And they were trying to start a war. And they needed to try to be able to pretend somehow that Saddam was connected to al-Qaeda. And the best that they could do was take Abu Musab al-Zarqawi from Anwar al-Islam, who was not a member of al-Qaeda, and who had nothing to do with Saddam Hussein or his intelligence services, and claim him as the link. Right? Which, you know, somebody out there who I've never met, right? That makes me, I'm the link between, you know, you and some other person you've never met. How do you like that? And so they let Zarqawi live. They forbid the Marine Corps from going in there and killing him. And so then Zarqawi, of course, up until he was killed about a year ago, went on to kill thousands and thousands of people in Iraq. And I hate to admit it, when Dick Cheney's right, did, I'm not saying that he definitely was responsible for the Samara Golden Dome bombing, because I don't think anybody ever proved that, but he definitely did his part to try to stoke tensions between Iraqis, between different sects of Iraqis, between the Sunnis and the Shia. Because if for example, Sadr, who is an Iraqi nationalist, even though he's a Shiite radical crazy who puts drills in people's heads, if he could have somehow formed a coalition with nationalist Sunnis, they might have been able to become the dominant force in the country. You know, if they could include a couple of Kurds in that. And America didn't want that. And Zarqawi and Al-Qaeda, who he did eventually join Al-Qaeda in January of 2004, that would have been bad news for the terrorists. And so they didn't want the Iraqi state to come together under single nationalism any more than the Americans did. And so they did do their best to stoke ethnic tensions, and it worked. And it's all George Bush's fault. And if you think, you know, that's some crazy conspiracy theory or what have you, you can read all about it at NBC News. Jim McLisheski, who from the time I was a little boy was the Pentagon reporter for NBC News, he's the guy who did the story on it. And there were 10 other people who followed up. I think Chris Floyd wrote a ton about it. The American military wanted to kill Zarqawi in Kurdistan before the war, but George Bush refused because they needed the lie that somehow Saddam was connected to Osama. And so they latched on to Zarqawi, who was actually connected to neither, as somehow the bridge between the two. So, yeah, I don't know. What the hell? Do you know? So, yeah, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio on Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. The phone number here is 646-6446. 646-6446. And I reckon if I can figure out which one to play, I'm going to dang old play another song for you. I know. I think I'll play this one. Chaos Radio in Austin.
Jerome, put on that Bobby Womack.
Nah, girl, I want to go way back. Oh, yeah, check this out.
Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. Back in the days
when I was just a little nigga, bro, I looked up to my bigger bro, begged if I could kick it. So when he went out with girls, I could go tagging along, nagging. If she had a sis, maybe could mac a baby hood rat. Y'all remember way back then when it was 1985, all the way live. I think I was about 10. One of those happy little niggas singing the blues that be always trying to bag with the shag and karate shit. Saying, yo mama black, his mama this, his mama that. Then he get mad and wanna scrap. We stay mad about 10 minutes, then it's like back on a bike to play hide and go get it with the younger hoes by the bungalows. Then switch to playing ding dong ditch when that gets old and too cold to hack it. Threw on a bomber jacket. You could tell the ballers cause they fell wearing gazelles. If they really had money raised, we sport knee case. And all the girls had they Turkish link. If it broke, then they made earrings too, like they meant to do it. But sometimes I still sit and reminisce and think about the years I was raised. Back in the day.
Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid.
And everybody say, I remember way back when.
And everybody say, I remember way back when.
What?
Back
I'm still back in the days, but now the year is 87, 88. That's when my crew and I were in junior high in seventh grade. I hated school.
Wish it had grown up.
No doubt I couldn't wait to get out
and be a grown up.
But let me finish this, reminiscing and telling about when girls were spelling tight corduroys like for the boys, basket weaves, Nike Cortez and footsie socks, and eating pickles with Tootsie Pops, and it don't stop. I'm glad, cause when JJ fed it supersonic, it was kinda like a sport to wear biker shorts or to wear jeans, and it seemed like the masses of hoochies had poison airbrushed on their asses. Dudes had on Nike suits and the boomers with the fat laces, cause it was either that or K-Swiss. I missed those days, and so I pout like a grown jerk, wishing all I had to do now was finish homework. It's true, you don't realize really what you got till it's gone, and I'm not gonna sing another sad song, but sometimes I do sit and reminisce and think about the years I was raised back in the day.
Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore, but some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore, but some days I sit and wish I was a kid again.
And everybody
back in the
say,
days
I
when I was young, I'm not
when.
A kid
and
anymore,
say,
but some days I sit and wish I was
when.
A kid
and everybody
back in the
say,
days
I
when I was young,
back
I'm not
when.
A kid anymore,
what?
But
back
some
in the
days
when?
I sit and wish
back
I was
in the
a kid.
And everybody say,
I remember way back when.
And everybody say,
I remember way back when.
And everybody say,
I remember way back when.
What?
Back in the days.
When?
Back in the days.
Well, it's the Niggero. I figure that now I'm all grown up, because I'm 18 years old, and guess you could say I'm holding down a steady job, and crew steady mobbing, you steady bobbing your head, and I'm paid, so I got it made, but didn't always have clout, used to live in South Central LA, that's where I stayed and figured a way out, I gave it all I had, so for what it's worth, I went from rags to riches, which is a drag, but now I'm first, so
on our way up.
Yeah, we said that we was gonna make it since a kid, and we finally did, but sometimes I still sit and reminisce, then think about the years I was raised back in the day.
Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore, but some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore, but some days I sit and wish I was a kid again.
And everybody
back in the
say,
days
I remember
when I was young,
way
I'm
back
not a kid
when.
Anymore,
and everybody
but some
say,
days I sit and wish I was a kid
when.
Again.
And everybody
back
say,
in the days
I remember
when
way
I was
back
young,
when.
I'm not a kid
All right, Charles, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and that was The Far Side with Back in the Days. And, yeah, so I'm Scott Horton, and, hey, by the way, I meant to tell you guys to check out antiwar.com. It's your best place for all the news in the whole damn world every single day, updated all day long, and, of course, every single day at midnight. What, 200 or 300 links to the most important news stories from around the world, and the very best in-house writers, Justin Raimondo, David Henderson, Ivan Elin, Alan Bach, Doug Bandow, Philip Giraldi, Neboj Samalik, Charles Pena, Ron Hacohen, Prodful Bidwai, Sacha Machusak, and a whole ton of additional contributors, including Pat Buchanan, Juan Cole, Gordon Prather, Tom Englehart, Aaron Glantz, Joshua Frank, Dar Jamail, myself, William S. Lind, Jim Loeb, Ray McGovern, Representative Ron Paul, Gareth Porter, Charlie Reese, Paul Craig Roberts, Mark Rothschild even, Michael Scheuer, Paul Sperry, John Basil Utley, Teresa Whitehurst, and others. So we are all plumbline libertarians. We feature the very best of the left, the very best of the right, in opposition to foreign empire and American Leviathan. So please, everybody, check out antiwar.com, your best source for anti-war news, viewpoints, and activities. My blog is thestressblog.com. That's where all the kooks hang out and argue in the comment section. And where the hell are you guys, man? How come no one will call in today? Do I smell? Am I even on the air? Can anybody hear me? Hello? Hello? Is this thing on? 646-6446. 646-6446. If you're out of town, 512-646-6446. The interviews that I do, it's primarily an interview show, it's supposed to be, and, I keep all the interviews at scotthortonshow.com. There's probably going on, say, I don't know, almost 300 of them or so now, 250, 275 or something. Really good interviews, dating back over the last 4 years, all available at scotthortonshow.com. And I hate to do this, but I got to, man, go to libertystickers.com. and buy stickers from the Scott Horton section. There's some really good ones, and I'll tell you, I've sent in dozens and dozens and dozens over the past few weeks, and I don't know if they're ever going to get around to making them and posting them up on the site, but if you check back the Scott Horton section at libertystickers.com, there should be a bunch of new ones going up there pretty soon, including the new one with Rudolph Giuliani on it that says American Fascist, and a bunch of other really good ones. So, yeah, that's me. Check out the Scott Horton section at libertystickers.com. Not everybody can have a radio show, but at least you can put hateful sayings on the back of your car. You know, here's something I didn't really, I read this outrageous quote yesterday, but I didn't have time really to confront it. This is from Saturday, April the 7th, the New York Times. Giuliani says nation at war requires him, and this was the quote. At a house party in New Hampshire, Giuliani suggested it was unclear which was farther along, Iran or North Korea, in the development of a nuclear weapons program. Well, let's see. North Korea has tested a nuclear bomb and admits to having, what, a dozen plutonium core atomic weapons? They kicked out the IAEA and the international inspectors for, what, 5 years after Bush unilaterally abrogated the agreed framework based on the lie that they were enriching uranium, which they weren't, which there's still no evidence to this day that they ever were. And then Iran, which is just barely able to enrich uranium at all, to 3.6% under the watchful eye of the IAEA inspectors. And Giuliani says it's unclear who's further along. Now, that means either A, the guy's a damned liar, or B, he doesn't know. Maybe he has no idea that North Korea actually tested a nuke last fall. It actually didn't work very well. It was kind of a half nuke in the way it went off. It fizzled is the way they called it, but they have nukes. Does he not know that North Korea has nukes and that there's no evidence whatsoever that Iran even has a nuclear weapons program at all, that their only nuclear technology is being developed directly under the watchful eye of the International Atomic Energy Agency? Don't they know that? Doesn't he know that? Does he not have a handler who can explain that to him? Or is Rudolph Giuliani just a liar? And in case you missed it yesterday, I'll go ahead. It's from the same article. This is from the New York Times. Then he casually lumped Iran with Al-Qaeda. Their movement, he's talking about Iran, their movement has already displayed more aggressive tendencies by coming here and killing us. What? Iran came here and killed us? What are you talking about? A reporter asked him later to clarify, in so much as Iran had no connection to the September 11th attacks. What the hell are you talking about, Giuliani? And he answered, oh, well, they have a similar objective in their angle at the modern world. In other words, he said, they hate America. Yeah, gee, I wonder why. I wonder why, you know, the average Iranian might, you know, wish a piano would fall on Rudolph Giuliani's head. The same reason as me, maybe? He's a liar? And a dumbass and a murderer and a doting husband, a doting loving husband to a woman who murders puppy dogs? Maybe that's why they hate him. Maybe they hate him because he keeps telling the world that they are Al-Qaeda. It won't be long now before Rudolph Giuliani is giving a State of the Union address announcing that Iran has attempted to buy yellow cake from Niger. And that Mohammed Atta met with Iranian intelligence in Prague, Czechoslovakia. I'm just counting the minutes. Already, this guy, he can't tell you the difference between the North Koreans' nuclear program and the Iranians. It's unclear who's further along, asserts Rudolph Giuliani. Unclear, he says. And then he turns around and he blames Iran for September 11th. And when a reporter says, wait a minute, imagine that, right? A reporter actually saying, wait a minute, to a politician. Oh, my God. Must have been the new girl. The new girl said, wait a minute. There's no Iran connection to September 11th. What do you mean they came here to kill us? And he says, oh, well, same difference. Yeah, they hate the modern world. They hate America for our freedom. And so same thing. Close enough. Iran, a nation state controlled by radical Shiite or conservative Shiite mullahs versus, say, Al-Qaeda. A stateless band of pirates who are Salafists, extreme Wahhabi Sunnis, who hate the Shiite dogs in Iran, as they call them, and would like nothing more than to see America overthrow Iran for them. Oh, same difference if you're Rudolph Giuliani. Yeah, same difference like the firefighters having radios that can tune into the police frequencies. Is that it, Giuliani? Same difference? Close enough? And of course, you all know, right? Because the media has done such a good job of explaining Rudolph Giuliani's legacy. Hundreds and hundreds of dead firefighters. The police were warned on their radios from the guy in the helicopter who could see the top of the building shaking. I believe the quote is, whoa, it's red hot, about 15 floors from the top, and it's creaking, and it looks like it's going to fall. Get everybody out of there. Yeah, the firefighters didn't get to hear that. The cops did. The NYPD heard that, and they got out. The firefighters didn't. And I don't know how many dozens or hundreds of them it was who were killed. I think it was hundreds. That's Giuliani's legacy. Giuliani, who blames Iran for September 11th. Giuliani, who can't tell you that Iran that there's no evidence whatsoever of an Iranian nuclear weapons program, and that the North Koreans have successfully, semi-successfully detonated atomic weapons. Yeah, Rudolph Giuliani, he's running for president. You like puppies? Rudolph Giuliani's wife murders helpless little puppies. Okay, so just remember that come primary day when you're stepping into the booth, and I know what you'll be thinking. Well, he is a fascist, and I'm for fascism. I really like the way the government's completely taking over the economy and destroying our Bill of Rights and destroying our currency by overextending our nation into all these aggressive wars. I really like that. Oh, but his wife murders puppies, you say? Oh, I'm sorry. America can't have a puppy murderer for First Lady. So, yeah, it's okay that he's a fascist. It's okay that he blames Iran for September 11th. Give me a break. That he can't tell you the difference between North Korea or Iran. He probably couldn't find either of them for you on a map. Those are all okay. The Patriot Act, he's for the Patriot Act, he's for the National Security Agency tapping your phone on the record. He's for all these things. And that's perfectly fine. But just remember that his wife murders helpless little puppy dogs. And that Rudolph Giuliani, who's no longer married to his cousin, let's be fair, is no longer married to his cousin, his new wife, who he loves and dotes on fanatically, murders helpless little puppies. Okay. I had a call. It was Gabe. Somehow this thing knew that it was Gabe that called in because it said Gabe right next to his phone number, but he hung up. He didn't have time to waste sitting around listening to me rant and rave about Iran and North Korea. So he went away. And now I got no callers. I guess I'll give out the number one more time if anybody cares. 646-646-646-6446. 512 is the area code if you're from out of town. 512-646-6446. And, you know, I don't know. Seems like somebody must be listening out there. There's a new book out about the Niger uranium forgeries. Hope I can get a hold of that. It seems like a good interview. I believe it's by, what's his name? Was it Carlo Bonini, the Italian reporter who wrote the great articles for La Repubblica about the Italian edge on those forged documents. And I guess it remains to be seen whether that investigation will include the aluminum tubes, which was also a lie, granted, thankfully, from the Italian intelligence agency, SISMI. So, yeah, interesting. We'll be looking into that. We know the Senate has sent some letters to Condoleezza Rice telling her that she better fess up under oath everything she knows about the Niger-uranium documents, which helped lie us into war in Iraq. So, believe me, we'll be keeping our eyes open on this show to find out what's going on there. But hey, it looks like I finally got a damn phone call. People, I guess they apparently really want to listen to me talk for 2 hours straight. I don't know. Welcome to the show, Gabe. Oh, he hung up. The son of a bitch hung up. All right, well, screw you, man. Maybe it hung up on him. I don't know. Maybe the boss was coming and he had to go. 646-6446. You unbelievable bastards. Why won't you call in? It's supposed to be a call-in show. Did I talk about how Iran can't make nukes? Iran can't make nukes. I got the LA Times here. Where'd it go? LATimes.com. Nope. Wrong LA Times. Where'd it go? Hang on. I got more LA Times here. Here we are, LA Times. Iran's nuclear claims raise fear, skepticism. Oh, here's Gabe again. Hey, Gabe, what's up, man? Hello? Oh, shit, I forgot to hit the button. Hang on, dude, don't hang up yet. Hey, dude, are you there now?
Yeah, man.
What's up,
Just
Gabe?
I'm listening to you on my lunch break here, dude. Keep on putting out the good word. No, man, I think you had technical difficulty. You dropped my call or whatever, but... No, man, I'm good to hear you getting the word out, dude. So what do you think, man? Are we really going to war in the next month, or am I not to believe all the conspiracy theories I read on the web?
Well, I don't know. I think the information that was saying it's going to be within the next month was mostly coming from the Russians and the French, so I wouldn't put too much stock in it. But, you know, I do think it would take both houses of Congress explaining explicitly to George Bush that he may not bomb Iran to stop him, and that might not even stop him. So... I do think it probably is a matter of time, although I won't put a timetable on it. If we were to go by the timetables, it would have been last Friday.
And what about, like, you know, those English guys that recently got released? What was up with that, dude? Was that some psyop? Or I still was trying to figure out what was going on, how they got released, and how they came out with stories, and they told them not to talk anymore. Do you know any insight on what that was all about?
Well, you know, the other Scott Horton, the head of the International League for Human Rights and former head of the New York Bar Association and so forth.
Yeah, you've interviewed him.
Yeah, I've interviewed him a couple of times, you may remember. He writes a great little blog thing at Harper's. And he had a little thing, which honestly I didn't get to really examine it, but he was basically... saying it looked like it was possible that there was a prisoner swap that took place, that some of the Iranians who had been arrested in Iraq, that the Brits negotiated and had America release some of these Iranians in exchange for their sailors. I don't think that's been proven, but at least that's one suspicion, was that that's how they got released. Also, it was just great public relations for Ahmadinejad to say, hey, happy Easter, you know, look at me and what a nice guy I am letting you, you know, letting these prisoners free. And just in terms of public relations, he stomped all over Tony Blair and George Bush last week, I think.
Yeah, what about North Korea, man? What are they rolling over on their belly now or what?
Yeah, well, actually, America has rolled over and showed our belly to North Korea, and they're standing there rubbing it with their foot. George Bush, here's what happened in a nutshell, Gabe, is Bill Clinton had a deal with North Korea that we would give them fuel oil and light water nuclear reactors that can't possibly be used to make nuclear weapons in exchange for them shutting down the Russian-built reactors they already had that can produce weapons-grade plutonium. And when George Bush came into power, he lied. He lied his ass off and accused North Korea of enriching uranium secretly. And one of John Bolton's little munchkins at the State Department lied and made up this story that a North Korean ambassador had confirmed it to him that they had a secret uranium enrichment program. And based on that lie, George Bush unilaterally abrogated the agreed framework with North Korea, broke the deal, and told them, no, you're not getting your light water reactors, and you're not getting any more fuel oil, et cetera, et cetera, and broke the deal. The North Koreans said, okay, fine, if that's the way you want to play it. They kicked out the IAEA, withdrew from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and announced that they were going to begin harvesting plutonium from their nuclear reactors and make nuclear weapons. They did this on the eve of the invasion of Iraq. They learned the lesson. Saddam doesn't have nukes. He gets invaded. Well, we're going to hurry up and make nukes, so we don't. And that's exactly what happened. And then now just 2 months ago, George Bush rolled over on his back and said, okay, North Korea, I'll tell you what. We'll give you whatever you want. And in fact, we'll give you the very same deal you had before, only now you get even more welfare than you did under the Bill Clinton deal. And that's what happened. Bush capitulated and rolled over and is now giving the North Koreans even more welfare than Bill Clinton did for them to abide by basically the same deal they had before.
But isn't that cheaper than invading them?
Oh, well, absolutely. I'm just making fun of the guy wherever I can, of course. You know, I don't care if North Korea has nukes.
Good work, dude. I got to get back to work, man. All right. I got to pay my taxes and shit.
Hey, thanks for calling in, Gabe. Appreciate it, bud.
All right, bro. Peace.
Take care, man. And somebody else called in there, but they dropped off. So anyway, you can call in again if you want. The lines are all clear. It's 646-6446, 646-6446, 512-646-6446 if you're from out of town. But I've been drinking coffee since like 9 o'clock in the morning. And believe me, I can keep going and not stop with this shit. LA Times. From today, April 10th, Iran's nuclear claims raise fear, skepticism. U.S. is concerned, but experts doubt Tehran can now enrich uranium on an industrial scale. Natanz, Iran. Iran's announcement Monday that it had achieved the capacity to enrich uranium on a, quote, industrial scale raises the fear that the Islamic Republic could manufacture a nuclear weapon within a year, but was met with deep skepticism from nuclear experts. Gee, let's see if we can't find who's closer to the truth. The fear mongers or the experts? President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, speaking here at an annual commemoration of the nation's nuclear program, described Iran as an established nuclear power. Iran is on its way to greatness, and nothing can stand in its way, he told the assembled crowd of 500 dignitaries, which included representatives of at least 45 countries. But Iran's claim, including an assertion that it had fed gaseous uranium into 3,000 centrifuges to begin purifying nuclear material on an industrial scale, was quickly disputed by many experts and officials. Independent experts largely portrayed the Iranian claim as a political statement designed to bolster both its international and domestic stature, rather than an indication that Tehran has reached a significant new milestone in its nuclear program. A White House spokesman said the Bush administration was, quote, very concerned about the nuclear program, quote, Iran continues to defy the international community and further isolate itself by expanding its nuclear program rather than suspending uranium enrichment, said Gordon Jonroe, a spokesman to the National Security Council. Left unsaid here, of course, is that Iran is perfectly within their rights to enrich uranium under their non-proliferation treaty, which they are still a signatory of. And if you can enrich uranium hexafluoride gas to 3.6%, that's great. You might be able to make a little electricity, boil some water, produce some steam, turn some cranks. But no, you cannot make a nuclear weapon out of low-grade enriched uranium. And the international community doesn't have any jurisdiction whatsoever. The United Nations Security Council, well, as with every other subject that they've had an opinion on in the last 65 years, they can shove it and die. The Security Council has no authority. They have no real authority at all. They definitely don't have authority to insist that Iran stop enriching uranium when they have every right under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It is the United Nations that is breaking the law, such as it is. Let's see here. It's very clever, said George Perkovich, head of the non-proliferation program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a Washington-based think tank. They're keeping their options open. They're saying, we've defied everyone. We've done it. They're declaring victory. That way, they can suspend later and come into compliance. Or they can blast forward. Oh, they can blast forward, yeah. Iran's claim to be able to produce nuclear fuel on an industrial scale is purposely vague, experts said, but it suggests that Iran is producing significant quantities of enriched uranium. Asked by reporters whether all 3,000 centrifuges had been injected with uranium gas, nuclear negotiator Ali Larijani replied yes. The oblique manner in which Larijani made the milestone public raised suspicions about its veracity. Few outside experts believe Iran has successfully installed and is operating such a large system. Western experts suggest Iran has no more than 1,000 such devices, which it can operate only part-time. A report in February by the UN nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, said Iran was able to operate about 328 centrifuges. I see you there, Shauna. Hang tight one sec. In the past, Iranian scientists have built and installed new centrifuges at a rate of 100 a month. Experts said it was highly unlikely that Iran had increased this rate substantially in recent weeks or achieved other technical breakthroughs critical to running the cascades of linked centrifuges at extremely high speeds. The final plan for the Natanz enrichment facility calls for the installation of 54,000 centrifuges. And, anyway, more and more, not a milestone, not a surprise, not a big deal. The IAEA is there, and the IAEA can see that, they are not enriching uranium on an industrial scale, and they surely are not enriching uranium to, the degree necessary to make atomic weapons. So, again, that's from today's LA Times. Nuclear claims raise fear, skepticism. Mark me in the skepticism column there, Joan. Could you put me down for skepticism rather than fear? Great, appreciate it. That was easy. Welcome to the show, Shauna.
Hey, Scott.
How's it going?
Remember the other day we were talking about how we were kind of mystified about some of the motivations for the war in Iran, particularly Cheney?
Yeah.
And it just occurred to me, maybe it's that thing, I'm not even sure who it was that I got the idea from, that what's going on with Iran is like a proxy war with Russia and or China. And, you know, Cheney, he is really hot to contain Russia and China.
That's a very good point. In fact, I like to wonder about whether Iran prefers we bomb. I mean, whether Russia prefers we bomb Iran or not. On one hand, I don't think they really want us spread completely across their southern border from Jordan to India. You know. On the other hand,
cutting off their pipeline project.
Right. On the other hand, there's no better way. In fact, I've said this a million times, and I'll say it again. There's no way at all to destroy America than tricking us into overextension and self-destruction. And I think if I was Russia and I was playing this game, my hope would be to draw America into, just like America drew Russia into their Vietnam and Afghanistan, draw us into another one. And this time in all of South Asia. And so I don't really know. On one hand, if I was Putin, I would want America to leave Iran the hell alone. On the other hand, why not? Because America's got to leave sooner or later, more likely sooner than later. And then Russia can move in. We'll be out of the way, and they can come on in and take it for themselves.
Well, of course, they already have contracts for a lot of it, them and China. And they've made quite a few deals for the natural gas and oil in Iran, even since all the blustering's been going on.
Yeah, well, and Russia, of course, is an oil and gas exporter. And
right.
One of the biggest in the whole world. But, you're right. There's actually somebody sent me a link just the other day to a book that I've got to get my hands on. It's called The New Great Game. And it's all about, all the Western powers fighting over South Asia, just like they did 100 years ago, 150 years ago. Only this time they're fighting over energy.
And by South Asia, what countries are you referring to?
Well, basically, from India and then westward from there until you get to Iraq or so. And okay. North of there, you know, I include the stands, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, all those countries as well, which we have bases in most of those countries now.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, that was just something that I thought of. And then also earlier you were talking about the whole concept of fighting a war somewhere so that we won't be attacked here. But that's still what Lynn would call second-generation warfare thinking. It's like there's these battle lines out there. And if we can hold their army back at another place, their army can't reach us here. But that's really the opposite of what terrorism actually achieves. There is no need for the army or the battle line. Terrorism can strike anywhere. And so the whole thing is just a terrible fallacy.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's based on the first assumption that there's some finite number of terrorists and that if we just kill them, they'll be gone, and completely ignores everything that we know about what causes all this suicide bombing in the first place. Foreign occupation. Of course there are more terrorists now than there were after September 11th. And we're just making matters worse. And as you say, this isn't a second generation set piece battle that takes place out on some grassy plain somewhere. And what we're talking about is individuals, committed individuals. And, you know, I thought this was an interesting little anecdote from William S. Lynn, the guy who has done the most to expand upon, and I don't know if he's the originator of it, but he's at least expanded and written a ton about fourth-generation warfare. And he talked about, I don't remember if he told this to me in an interview, Shauna, or if this was somewhere else I read this or something, but a Marine Corps, I believe it was a Marine Corps Special Forces, Force Recon General, said to him, fourth-generation warfare, my guys fight fourth-generation warfare. We're already great at that, man. We already know we don't third-generation. We're already fourth-generation warfare. William S. Lynn said, oh, really? Are you willing to strap your daughter with explosives and send her off to the marketplace? And the general said, no. And he said, all right, then you don't know the first goddamn thing about generation warfare. Go read a book. You know, get out of my face. Go read something and come back. Talk to me again. And yes, I mean, the idea that somehow, you know, this flypaper theory is going to just, you know, stick all the flies to a rock rather than generating them. I mean, I guess that's really the thing. If we want to stick to that analogy, this isn't flypaper. This is a steak. And yeah, it'll draw flies to it, but there will be more and more growing out of it, you know, within a few days.
All right. Good analogy.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. It's theirs, and I had to roll with it. God damn it. All right. Okay. Thanks for calling, Shauna.
All right. Bye.
All right. That was Miss Shauna Kay, the beer princess. And here's some music.
They just hope that he'll never wake up, because they never want to meet him on the battlefield.
War, third, three, in the third half, you heard I got quick, they clever at the level of a scientist. With fist, lift, mom, fist, pump, jump, and don't miss. Saw him a target grudge against the enemy and any other nigga with an attitude. See, and any other rapper who's a brother trying to speak to one another. Get smothered by the other. Kind, not so divine. So I heard to the great my friend, the fans out to get my time. Yo, to go pro to a 90-91 rapper. When it's looking for my 90 to accelerate the race from the trench. Look at my face and they hate, but they don't want it to face to take break. Can I live my life without them treating every brother like me? Like I'm holding a knife for right time. The smack who's the same, I don't give a damn. Look at the flag, above the flood without credit. Black and close to the edit. I said it, you read it, just remember who said it.
Public Enemy's leader,
Tree Standish.
Wow.
Tree Standish.
Chuck D.
Wow. Tree Standish.
Don't challenge them in theology. Don't challenge them political thinking. Don't challenge them in education. Don't challenge them. progress.
All right, Charles, welcome back. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. This is Radio Chaos 95.9. And listen, I just wanted to point you guys at the viewpoint section today on antiwar.com. We've got, well, at least I haven't read them all yet, but I've read four of them, and they're all killer so far. The Theater of the Imperially Absurd by Tom Englehart. If you're not familiar with him, he does the Tom Dispatch. That's his website. And basically, he's an editor, and he has all these great writers, almost all liberal writers, who will write these great essays, and then he'll write a great essay as an introduction to their great essay. So it's almost always by Tom Englehart and one other guy kind of thing. This one is just by Tom Englehart. It's called The Theater of the Imperially Absurd, and it's a great article. Your Iraq Plan is a Pointless Question by Andrew J. Basevich. You can never go wrong reading Basevich. I highly recommend his book, The New American Militarism. Of course, I read a whole article by him on the show last Friday. And then two articles by paleoconservatives who opposed the invasion of Iraq, Robert Novak and Patrick J. Buchanan. Featured today at antiwar.com. Robert Novak, worse than apartheid? This is Novak writing in today's Washington Post, quoting a Palestinian who, you know, it seems to be a rhetorical question, and Novak, by my reading, is pretty satisfied that what's going on in the West Bank is at least as bad as apartheid, if not worse. And so that's Robert Novak. He did oppose the war in Iraq, and he's got a great article. He's hardly my favorite conservative pundit, but there you go. Worse than apartheid by Robert Novak, and What a Lack of Courage Cost by Pat Buchanan. And in fact, this one's short enough. I think I can just go ahead and read through this Pat Buchanan article really, really quick here. This is from antiwar.com today. What a Lack of Courage Cost by Pat Buchanan. As Chairman Carl Levin of Senate Armed Services conceded Sunday, Congress is not going to defund the war in Iraq, even if Bush vetoes every Democratic timetable for withdrawal. The war will go on, backed by a Democratic Congress. If Majority Leader Reid is not bluffing about his threat to vote with Russ Feingold to cut off funds, Harry will be rolled by a bipartisan coalition that includes dozens of members of his own caucus. For Democrats, recall the consequences of having voted to cut off funds for the war in Vietnam, which JFK and LBJ had plunged the United States into, which JFK and LBJ had plunged the United States. Whatever Americans think about a war, they are not a forgiving crowd when it comes to those perceived as having abandoned the troops or ensured defeat. That is what Democrats are toying with today. That is why the GOP has begun to pound Speaker Pelosi after her runway strut through the Middle East to get her vacationing colleagues back to Washington and get that $100 billion for the troops and the war passed. No matter how Harry and Nancy bridle, the Congress they lead will give Bush exactly what he demands. And the final vote to fund the war, no strings attached, will tear at the seams of the Democratic Party, whose base favors a rapid, if not immediate, withdrawal. The Democratic Congress thus faces this April a humiliating climb down, and all because of a Democratic Senate's vote in October 2002. Tom Daschle, Harry Reid, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, John Edwards, Joe Biden, Chris Dodd, all assenting to give George Bush his blank check for war. If I had known then what I know now, I never would have voted for the war, John Edwards assures us of the most important vote that he, Hillary, Biden, and Dodd ever cast, the votes that ensured America would commit the greatest strategic blunder of their lifetimes. This is not to absolve President Bush of culpability for what historians will surely call Bush's war, or the neoconservatives who howled for war in Iraq from the moment the planes hit the towers and who had plotted and propagandized for war in Iraq for years before 9/11. Yet Democratic courage in October 2002 might have stopped the stampede, for Democrats were the last best hope of the opponents of war. But they failed the nation. What the nation got was a vote to, quote, get the issue behind us so Democrats could focus on holding the Senate, which they lost in any event. Now that we have passed the 4-year mark in a war that has lasted longer than the war between the states or World War II, what does the profit and loss statement look like? On the credit side, Iraq has been liberated from Saddam Hussein and a Ba'ath party that tyrannized and terrorized Iraqis for decades. Saddam is dead, his henchmen have met justice, and none will hold power again. Kurds are free, the Shia are liberated from Saddamite and Sunni oppression. The price of liberation, however, is scores of thousands of Iraqi dead, many tortured and murdered by their own kinsmen, a ravaged nation, a sectarian civil war, Al-Qaeda in Anbar, 2 million exiles, the flight of Iraqi Christians, the probable breakup of the nation, and the reversion of Iraq to the status of a failed state. For America, the consequences have been enormous when one considers that measured by U.S. casualties, this is not a major war. We have lost 3,300 dead and 25,000 wounded, with no end to the bleeding in sight. The worldwide sympathy America enjoyed after 9/11 is history. America is severed from old allies and despised around the world. Our reputation suffers from Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, Haditha. The material costs of the war run into the hundreds of billions and hundreds of billions more before it ends. The U.S. Army is, quote, breaking or, quote, almost broken, depending on whether one agrees with the ex-Army Chief of Staff or Colin Powell. America's position in the Middle East is as imperiled as ever as it was in the Cold War, with the King of Saudi Arabia accusing us of an illegal foreign occupation of Iraq, and Arab peoples professing pandemic detestation of America and preferring Osama bin Laden as man and leader to George W. Bush. Most Americans are bitter at how the world perceives us today, given the sacrifices we made over 60 years to ensure that freedom did not die. You know Pat, he's an old Cold Warrior. And the world would be a better place, but then gratitude has never been a long suit of the human race. Yet if the world does not love us, and the American Empire is gone, are we not well rid of it? Perhaps Bush should be thanked for having shown it is not worth the cost, and for having booted it away. And I like the way that ends on a little bit of a silver lining. You know, maybe George Bush has wrecked the imperial car beyond repair. Maybe the Vietnam syndrome that we're coming down with now will be impossible for the American elite to overcome. I like to think so. You know, there's got to be something good to have come of all this wanton industrialized slaughter. But maybe not. 646-6446, 646-6446, 512-646-6446, if you're out of town. Syria, Elliot Abrams and the Contras, All Over Again by Jim Loeb. It has an all-too-familiar ring to it. A crisis area, in this case the Middle East, finds itself in a desperate need of a peace process capable of tamping down the forces of violence and destabilization, which the United States itself has played a central role in unleashing. Regional efforts at diplomacy, in this case led by Saudi Arabia, gain some momentum but are frustrated by diehard hawks in the U.S. administration. While increasingly on the defensive both home and abroad, they are determined to carry through their strategy of isolating and destabilizing a hostile target, in this case Syria, despite its oft-repeated eagerness to engage Washington and its regional allies. Sensing an increasingly dangerous impasse, the Democratic Speaker of the House of Representatives, in this case Nancy Pelosi, backed by a growing bipartisan consensus that the administration's intransigence will further reduce already waning U.S. influence in the region, tries to encourage regional peace efforts by engaging the target directly. But, worried that her quest might actually gain momentum, administration hawks, in this case led by Deputy National Security Advisor Elliot Abrams and Vice President Dick Cheney, accused the speaker of undermining the president and working through obliging editorial writers at the Washington Post, among other sympathetic media, including, of course, the Wall Street Journal, attack her for, quote, substituting her own foreign policy for that of a sitting Republican president. If that scenario sounds familiar, your foreign policy memory dates back to at least 1987, when despite intensified regional peacemaking efforts, for which Costa Rican President Oscar Arias won that year's Nobel Peace Prize, the Ronald Reagan administration was persisting in its efforts to isolate and overthrow the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. It was then House Speaker Jim Wright, who, with the quiet encouragement of Republican realists, notably Reagan's White House Chief of Staff Howard Baker, Secretary of State George Shultz, and his special Central America envoy Philip Habib, sought to promote Arias's plan. Like today's Republican realists on the Iraq Study Group who have urged the Bush administration to engage rather than continue to isolate Syria, they understood that popular and congressional support for a regime change policy in Nicaragua was not sustainable, and Washington should seek a regional settlement on the most favorable terms available. But Abrams, then Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, worked assiduously with fellow hardliners in the White House and the Pentagon, just as he works today with Cheney's office, to torpedo both the Arias plan and Wright's efforts to advance it through the latter half of 1987. As Abrams' assistant at the time, the future neoconservative heavy thinker Robert Kagan put it later, Arias, more than any other Latin leader, single-handedly undid U.S. policy in Nicaragua. And when he won the Nobel Peace Prize, quote, all of us who thought it was important to get aid for the Contras reacted with disgust, unbridled disgust. As part of their strategy, hardliners led by Abrams rejected appeals by Nicaragua for high-level talks, thus forcing Habib to resign by late summer and insisting, as they do now with Syria, that direct negotiations would serve only to legitimate Sandinistas and demoralize the Contras. In November 87, Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega came to Washington with a proposal for a ceasefire with the Contras. After the administration refused to receive him, Wright, seeking an opportunity to jumpstart a stalled peace process, attended a meeting at the Vatican Embassy here, at which Ortega asked his main domestic foe, Cardinal Miguel Obando y Bravo, to mediate between the Sandinista government and the Contras. Wright's participation in the talks was seized by Abrams as the launching pad for a public, if barely concealed, attack on the speaker. Interviewed by the Post under the guise of an unnamed senior administration official, Abrams charged Wright with engaging in guerrilla theater and an unbelievable melodrama that had dealt a serious setback to the administration's policy. This was not forward movement. This was screwing up the process, the senior official complained to the Post, which, as in its criticism Friday of Pelosi's meeting with Assad, obligingly followed up with its own editorial entitled, What is Jim Wright Doing? Charging the speaker with having acted, quote, as though the actual conduct of diplomacy in this delegate passage were his responsibility. The Journal's neoconservative editorial writer swiftly joined in, accusing Wright of a, quote, compulsion for running off-the-shelf foreign policy operations. Ha! Just as last week, isn't that funny? Accusing the speaker of running secret foreign policy operations in the midst of the secret war in Nicaragua. I like that. Just as last week, they charged Pelosi and Democrats of seeking to, quote, conduct their own independent diplomacy. Within just a few hours of his meeting with Ortega, however, the Democratic-led Congress rejected Reagan's request to fund the Contras, a step that Abrams incorrectly predicted at the time would result in the dissolution of Central America. According to Roy Gutman's aptly named 1988 book about Reagan's Central America policy, Banana Diplomacy, Washington soon found itself at the margins of the region's diplomacy. Unlike his high profile as Assistant Secretary 20 years ago, Abrams, who now presides over Middle East policy at the National Security Council, is today far more discreet, no doubt in part because of his conviction in 1991 for lying to Congress about his role in the Iran-Contra scandal, has made him an easy target for Democrats. He's very careful about not leaving fingerprints, one State Department official told IPS earlier this year. But there is little doubt among Middle East analysts here that Abrams is playing a lead role in White House efforts to discredit Pelosi for meeting with Assad, just as he did with Wright for meeting with Ortega in 1987. And just as he worked with Reagan hardliners to undermine the Arias plan 20 years ago, so he appears to be doing what he can to undermine recent efforts by the Saudi King Abdullah to initiate an Arab-Israeli peace process, and for that matter by Republican realists and even Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to push it forward. And that was the indispensable Jim Loeb, writing for Interpress Service in the top of the frontline section today at antiwar.com. And, you know, that really just kind of goes with my whole sort of theory about the Bush administration. It's basically one big Iran-Contra scandal from beginning to end. One brig law-breaking, secret-keeping, aggressive warfare-waging, mass murderous regime of theft and death. And almost all of it without oversight. That is what the Bush administration is, the Iran-Contra administration. And the fact that it's people like Elliot Abrams up there running the show shouldn't be any surprise whatsoever to anybody. And again, the Speaker of the House of Representatives can go anywhere she wants. And she can make any, she can meet with any political leader that she feels like. And there's no law, no tradition, even, that says otherwise. None. And anybody who accuses her of committing some crime, for going to Syria, you know, why not Googling around a little bit? You'll find out that the whole thing was arranged by the State Department. She had State Department people with her the whole time. All she succeeded in doing was getting herself set up by Ehud Olmert, who told her to tell the Syrians that the Israelis are ready for peace, just so he could come out and say, I did not say that, stupid Pelosi trying to undermine my argument, blah, blah, which was obviously a setup from the American government. But they want to say the Speaker of the House of Representatives of the American people, in the U.S. Congress, cannot go to Syria and meet with somebody because Bush wants a regime change there. And if you talk to this guy, then we might not be able to get a regime change. And you might ask yourself, it would be fair for you to ask, why do we want regime change in Syria? Don't they torture people for us whenever we ask them to? Hasn't Syria been cooperative in the war on terror? Don't they torture and murder people for the United States of America? Yes, they do. Syria is our ally. When we need somebody tortured or murdered, we give them to Syria and say, torture and or murder this person for us, please. And they do. So what's the trouble? Why do we need a regime change? The Syrians are good little torturers. They do what they're told. But somehow it's a crime for the Speaker of the House of Representatives to go and meet with their dictator. Give me a break. And, you know, I don't know. See, give me a break isn't the right argument. I got to take that a different direction. The point is here, we have a major problem when the, I don't know if it's the right and the left, the blue and the red and the whatever, the pro and the anti-war. When we're having two entirely different sets of arguments, And they don't ever seem really to compare notes with each other, the people who are doing the arguing. If you read a left-wing blog about this kind of thing, you'll see them make a great case, but completely fail to address the points that the right-wingers are making, and vice versa. And, you know, the people who think that Pelosi is a criminal for going and meeting with Assad, they're not listening to this show. They're listening to the show that says it's a crime. And our two arguments don't even get to confront each other. My evidence doesn't get to confront theirs. You know, they say she's in violation of the Logan Act. I say the Logan Act specifically excludes Congress. That's the one that says you can't go making American foreign policy unless you work for the president. Congress is excluded from that. Okay, but that argument isn't heard on the pro-war side. They're having an entirely separate argument, which is, of course, based all on fallacies about how the president is supposed to be able to make up foreign policy. And as I talked about with Ivan Elin on the show last week, and as I've said myself a million times over these airways, the president doesn't have the foreign policy authority. Read the Constitution. Congress has all the authority. All legislative powers reside in the Congress. The president can receive ambassadors, big whoop, but he can't make a deal with them except treaties that must be ratified by a supermajority of the imperial senate. He can appoint ambassadors, but again, they must be confirmed by a supermajority of the imperial senate. And all legislative powers reside in the Congress, the House, and the Senate. of the United States. The president is not the king. He does not have authority to make foreign policy, only to carry it out. And, you know, I'm not here to, you know, to sing high praise for Nancy Pelosi, who's about as disgusting as any one of the warmonger Republicans in either house. I can't stand the woman myself, but the fact that she's trying to say, you know, hey, look, we can talk to these people rather than just dropping bombs on them. The fact that somehow that is being construed as treason against the United States, that somehow Pelosi's on the side of the terrorists and wants them to win, et cetera, et cetera. It just goes to show how removed the debate in this country, how removed the two sides of the debate are from each other. You know, go read the right-wing blogs. Read the comment sections on the right-wing blogs. It's really crazy. I mean, they really do think that anybody who disagrees with them really does hate America and really wants to have, you know, mullahs or you know, crazy Arabs with swords forcing us to believe in their religion and dominate, control our society. They really think that. You know, first of all, that's possible, you know, anytime in the next 500 years or something. But second of all, that's what they think that the anti-war forces in America want. They've convinced themselves that. They tell each other that. And apparently they don't have any arguments to confront that don't reinforce that belief. And, you know, that's when we're in pretty deep trouble here, y'all. When somebody can really say that the speaker and really believe that the speaker of the House of Representatives wants Syria to conquer America. And that's why she's committed this act of high treason in defying the president to go and have this meeting. If people can convince themselves that, if people can hear that and then turn around and parrot it and believe it's true in this country, then we are still in real deep trouble. I don't know what percentage of the American people are buying into this crap, but it's enough that it's a problem. It's definitely enough that it's a problem. Hey, I wanted to share a little bit of inhumanity with you here in the form of this article. Bodies? What bodies? From Alternet. I'm not going to read the whole thing, I promise. I'm going to skip ahead to the good part. This is by Patrick J. Sloyan, S-L-O-Y-A-N, posted on November 25th, 2002. Bodies? What bodies? And this is about the first Gulf War. It wasn't until late in the afternoon of February 25th that the press pool was permitted to see where the attack occurred. There were groups of Iraqi prisoners. About 2,000 had surrendered. But there were no bodies, no stench of feces that hovers on a battlefield, no blood stains, no bits of human beings. You get a little firefight in Vietnam and the bodies would be stacked up like cordwood, Daniel said. Finally, Daniel found the division's public affairs officer, an army major. Where the hell are all the bodies? Daniel said. What bodies? The officer replied. Daniel and the rest of the world would not find out until months later why the dead had vanished. Thousands of Iraqi soldiers, some of them alive and firing their weapons from World War I-style trenches, were buried by plows mounted on Abrams' main battle tanks. The Abrams flanked the trench line so that tons of sand from the plow spoil funneled into the trenches. Just behind the tanks, actually straddling the trench line, came M2 Bradleys pumping 7.62mm machine gun bullets into the Iraqi troops. Quote, I came through right after the lead company, said Army Colonel Anthony Moreno, who commanded the lead brigade during the first Mex assault. Quote, what you saw was a bunch of buried trenches with people's arms and legs sticking out of them. For all I know, we could have killed thousands. A thinner line of trenches on Moreno's left flank was attacked by the 1st Brigade, commanded by Colonel Lon Maggart. He estimated his troops buried about 650 Iraqi soldiers. Darkness halted the attack on the Iraqi trench line. By the next day, the 3rd Brigade joined the grisly innovation. A lot of people were killed, said Colonel David Weissman, the unit commander. One reason there was no trace of what happened in the neutral zone on those 2 days were the ACEs. It stands for Armored Combat Earth Movers. And they came behind the Armored Burial Brigade, leveling the ground and smoothing away projecting Iraqi arms, legs, and equipment. PFC Joe Queen of the First Engineers was impervious to small arms fire inside the cockpit of the massive earth mover. He remained cool and professional as he smoothed away all signs of the carnage. Queen won the Bronze Star for his efforts. A lot of guys were scared, Queen said, but I enjoyed it. Colonel Moreno estimated that more than 70 miles of trenches and earthen bunkers were attacked, filled in, and smoothed over on February 24th, 25th. What happened at the neutral zone that day has become a metaphor for the conduct of modern warfare. While political leaders bask in voter approval for destroying designated enemies, they're increasingly determined to mask the reality of warfare that causes voters to recoil. And this goes on. There's much more to this story. It's called Bodies? What Bodies? And it's at Alternet. By Patrick J. Sloyan, November 25th, 2002. And it's about the highway of death and about the burial of Iraqi soldiers after the first Gulf War, many of them still alive, buried alive in their trenches by American bulldozers after they'd surrendered, after the war was over and the ceasefire had been declared. They hate us because we're free. Not because we buried their father alive. Would you? You wouldn't hate somebody if they buried your father alive, would you? Of course not. Now, if the people who buried your father alive were free, you might hate them for that. Am I right? Huh? Am I making sense? I guess so. So that's the way things are for April 10th, 2007. I'm Scott Horton. This has been Anti-War Radio, and here I only got a couple of calls, man, 2 hours straight of talking, and I still have, you know, 10 news stories here that I didn't even get a chance to review for you. Judge rejects Padilla's torture argument. Yeah, it's okay for the government to torture you and then use tortured so-called confessions against you in court. This is the USA, don't you know? It's always been like that. And damn it, that's it. Let me find some music to click on. Let's see here. How about this one? Step into world, Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas.
Island of Austin!
Be back tomorrow from 11 to 1.
All of them awesome!